This is Hidden Tillers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Drake.
To Nick Reiner case. And this one does hit differently because everybody thought they knew the ending before the story even started. Rob Reiner spent five decades making America laugh and think, and then he and his wife, Michelle, were found stabbed to death in their own Brentwood home with their own son under arrest before the sun even came up. Since then, it's been 9 months of continuances, a defense attorney who bailed out for reasons nobody's allowed to say, although I think we all kind of knew. And now a preliminary hearing pushed all the way to September while both sides wade through terabytes of evidence. The people writing in aren't asking about court dates either. They're asking the one question that's impossible to shake, and that is, how do you go from Meathead and Princess Bride to your own child accused of ending your life, and can anyone have seen it coming? Your thoughts.
Well, I mean, I think we were all surprised to hear the news that night. I was not aware, you know, I was a fan of Rob Reiner, liked him on All in the Family, loved a lot of his movies.
Got my goosebumps. Yeah, me too.
thought the guy was a genius when it came to creating art in that way, shape, or form. Didn't know a lot about the family and certainly didn't know that Nick was around and had the struggles that he had throughout life with substance abuse and some other things, some mental illness and all that kind of stuff. So when it happened, I was very surprised that it happened. One of the questions we have is, you know, how young was he when he was throwing temper tantrums and things like that? I personally have not seen any information that would necessarily guarantee an exact answer on that. I don't know if either one of you have. Yep. But it's a very sad story. And again, I was not aware of who Nick Reiner was until this all happened.
Yeah. The research I showed and I did on it was, again, this is just reported from colleagues, friends, family. And to your point, too, you know, we're not going to see these things, but their social group, they're involved with a lot of clubs, groups, organizations where they were at. Again, just being, I think, in the social end of Hollywood that they were, there was knowns and unknowns. So I don't think he, especially when they made a movie together, a special, it's not like he was hiding his son or hiding his family. So I think they were seeing a lot. Because what I saw here from my research was at around the age 11 and before, family and friends and insiders, as again, take that with a grain of salt sometimes, they were seeing very young age, terrifying tantrums and violent outbursts from a very young age. Again, when we're looking at patterns of behavior and life arcs, as I talk about, the first thing I'm looking for is this an enigma? Is this a spike out of the norm of what we saw or what other people were seeing over a period of time, or wasn't it? And from everything we're seeing, from what was reported and even, you know, the night of the horrendous murders themselves, he had a pattern of violent behavior throughout his entire life. And going unchecked, it's going to keep escalating until some sort of firmer guardrails of some sort are put into place. And this is not any way ever victim blaming in this at all, because hindsight is always 20/20 when things go sideways, because never in a million years do we ever expect we're going to die, and never in a million years do we ever expect someone in our life is going to be the cause of that death. And so it's very hard to predict these things.
It's also hard for when a child of say that the age that we're going to go for is 11. If the child is showing violent tendencies, is having these uncontrollable outbreaks and rages, the current mental health processes are not going to jump in and diagnose that as any sort of schizo or schizoaffective disorder, because that is a child. And that's part of the problem. When a child shows those aberrations that early, they don't want to label them in case it's something else. But then again, they're not getting the help if they are early onset schizoaffective or schizophrenia. Do you follow what I'm saying?
Oh yeah. And you know, okay. So, you know, fear of the labeling can be a part of it. Like you said, I was looking at, because I know one of the other questions that we had was, what could they have done? What could be done differently? What kind of parenting style did they use? That kind of thing. There's really, and to your point, Lisa, there's not a lot, you know, you can use a firmer, more controlled environment. I actually looked it up. I'll look it up again in a second. I have in my notes. But outside of that, because like the, even the conservativeship, we've covered this before on a show, the conservativeship where someone is actually in control of his life and you can actually put someone away for their own safety and well-being is extremely limited by the law about how long you can do that for. It's mm-hmm. it's like literally just days. And if you're doing all the things that are expected, like going to rehab, what was it, 8 times, 9 times? Again, I'm just going off the top of my head. It was up there in numbers. You're playing the game. You're playing the system. And when you have compassionate, empathetic parents that are loving and caring and not wanting to, because basically, I mean, Nick trauma bonded them to him. You know, it's like they became afraid of confrontation because you don't want it to get worse. And so you get into that method of not being too firm because you're afraid of where it could go. And so you're trying to manage that you're trying to manage chaos is what you're trying to do. And so, but I'm with you on the system definitely keeps failing on the mental health issues.
It really does. And this is not something against the parents, but like you, to what you mentioned, they can be try to be firm, but then they see what is just heartbreaking. Let's mm-hmm. say I'm going to use a little bit of a personal allegory here. My son had some mental health problems and had to go to the hospital for a little while because his medication was completely off the charts and he was having some delusions and some hallucinations. It was all med-based, but we were honestly scared at the beginning that it was early onset schizophrenia. Thank goodness it wasn't. But what I'm saying is it takes that time of completely taking off medication when there's problems like this and figuring out exactly what is the problem. And a lot of people can't stop and do that. And let me tell you, it was hard to see my 12-year-old son completely sedated out of his mind at the first part of it as they're pulling him off of everything. It's very hard to see and you don't want to see it. So you're like, I'm going to take them home. I can do this. We can do this at home. See what I'm saying?
Yeah. So, and Lisa, you bring up a really good point there that struck me as you're saying this. You had a hard time doing this because it's your son. Yes. This is why I talk about the concept of loving critic so often. And you guys met my loving critic at Tony's wedding, my wife.
And we love her, by the way. We have to say she's wonderful.
Thank you. Yeah, she makes me a better person. Well, we make each other better people because that's what happens. And so because we ourselves are so close to a problem sometimes, we can't be objective for ourselves. That's why we need a loving critic to be our one who cares about us, but not the outcome we seek. And so my wife, for me, when I get too vested in something, I have an emotional outcome of what I'm trying to achieve. She's my loving critic. She gives me objectivity because she has deep love and caring for me. What happens in families also, I mean, imagine this. You need a family because, Lisa, you gave a great example of you are so emotionally vested in your son. You're overwhelmed by the situation. You're scared by the situation. You're fearful of labels, meanings, because you're so close. You couldn't be your own loving critic in that moment. So what helps people, both you and then in the Reiner's case, is for them not to make the decisions. They're the ultimate decision maker, but having a loving critic, a loving family, counselors, whatever it is, someone you trust that is vested in your success, but not the outcome you seek, that can be that loving critic to say, listen, this is going a little bit sideways. You need to do this, specifically of Nick. Or in your case, say, listen, it's going to be okay, Lisa. It's just medication. Calm down. Don't worry about it. You know, so which we that's why we have professionals and medicine and all that. But a lot of times those aren't enough because you don't feel they're vested enough in you, your family, how much they care. That's why the healthier, stronger relationships we have with each other in relationships, the better it can be. And that's why, you know, I'm digressing in this, but that's why we have the great team here at True Crime Today, you know, and Hidden Killers, because we were all so vested in each other because we care deeply so that we can be each other's. And we do, that's why we check in with each other. Here's what's going on. Here's what we think about this. What do you want to do about this? Tony's out. Oh my God, we're going to freak out. Tony's away. So all these things, because we're constantly doing it for each other. So when things go sideways in our other parts of lives, realize, all right, I'm too close to this problem. I need a loving critic part of my life for this.
Moving on to a question from Ray. He slapped this on our YouTube comments. He says, they fought at a party hours before the murders and everyone just went home. What does that say when people around them had apparently grown used to this behavior? Robin?
Yeah, they got normalized.
Yeah.
And that also shows that this wasn't an isolated behavior. It shows that it was an escalating pattern over time. It became, not that they thought it was okay, but it became accepted and normalized because Nick had normalized it and his parents bringing him to places must have normalized it as well. So you have a part, and I'm not going to completely blame it all on that, or not blame it, rationalize it on that. There's also fear of taking action. Because you don't want to be the one person to call. And that's why we have, and we covered on one of the shows, Todd, you put up the number of the violence, not the violence prevention hotline. It's the,
Is it domestic something?
Yeah, it's the one I'm a spokesman for now. I'm trying not to confuse it with the violence prevention hotline. But it's like that. So if you think there's a threat of impending violence against someone or something, and you're a third party and you're afraid to make a move and you're afraid to call law enforcement, and you're afraid to confront someone, you call the hotline because they can actually help you as their trained counselors on those hotlines and trained operators to actually work through that with you. That's one of these cases that could help that a lot. But what, God, I'm not blaming anyone at this party, but at the same time though, that's a moment where loving critics in the Reiner's family could have stepped in and or could have hopefully have done something and say, listen, Rob, that was a little unleashed what we saw tonight. What's going on? Are you safe tonight? Now, granted, would they probably say, yeah, we're fine. He probably does this all the time, you know, kind of thing. So could that have happened? Yeah. But, and who knows? We'll only know when he goes to trial. That could have happened as well because, man, people, families, when you're that close, I mean, can you imagine the Reiners who love their son so much that they're willing to put up with so much? If even if one of these people from that party said, I fear for your life, Rob and Michelle, you need to do something. You can imagine them saying, we got it. Correct?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Absolutely.
100%.
It's a hard place to be.
And I think it's even harder in this, you know, I'm not trying to you know, make them out to be more than they are. But in Los Angeles and California and Hollywood, I think the last thing you want to do as is draw attention to something, right? Because you don't want it to be out in the press and stuff like that. So that may have hindered some of their loving critics from making phone calls or really saying, hey, Robin, Michelle, you got to do something about this. People may have, you know, had hands off a little bit more because they're from California, because they're in Hollywood and in that whole thing. I can't imagine knowing that this was going on in the family and maybe not being able to do much about it just because of the line of work you're in.
And think about this. It makes complete sense too. So here's Rob and Michelle, extremely successful. And it's not like this has been unknown and a spike. They gave the appearance of, well, we've been dealing with it a long time. They've obviously have it handled for this long. It's a horrendous situation. It's tough on it, but it's them. They know what they're doing. They're successful. They must have the right answers. And so people also defer to a position of authority, title, position, all that also plays in because it's never just one thing. It's always a conglomeration of many that play into these things. And I think that definitely came to play. So imagine this. If it had been someone that didn't have that same title and position, say it was one of us with one of our kids, the likelihood of someone having the courage without a title and position to intervene in our family, if we saw that same behavior, can you imagine it being more or less?
I don't know if it would be more or less, but I would think it would be about the same. I don't know if I could step up and get into somebody's family's business, although Lisa might disagree with that because we're so close.
I heard you. I don't know.
I was just going to say, oh, Todd, you know, you'll get up in somebody's business. But think about though, if it's not like your uber close friends, you're just in a situation where you see this kind of thing happening, say it's your neighbor's house and you're noticing the escalation. We're in the society where it's like, I'm sorry, not my circus, not my monkeys. Right. You know, we're all looking the other way.
Yeah, that definitely comes into play as well. Anyway,
got one more question on this topic, I think.
Yeah, sure.
Here's a good one. Everyone's whispering insanity defense. All right. But the burden of proof is on him to prove it, not the state to disprove it. Does that seem backwards to anyone else? And I'll make a very quick response here. No. Like, I think if you're going to go for an insanity defense, I really feel like that should be up to the defense side to try and prove that. I don't think it should have to be disproved. That's just an opinion, though.
Yeah, and I agree. The level required for insanity defense is extremely high. And I'm not a licensed psychologist or clinician, so I always want to caveat things like that. But the level of testing needed to be done is really, really high. I looked this up, by the way, so I just want to double check my stats on it. I think, what was it? It's like only 2-3% of attempts for not guilty by reason of insanity as a defense is like 2-3%. It is really, really low.
Yeah.
To be able to claim it, because the bar for reaching that, I remember from growing up, used to hear that a lot more, where people are kind of excusing really, really, really important behavior because they got a broken brain. I think people really got smart to that because people were taking advantage of the mental health system, which is in shambles, but it's not nearly like it was anymore. Let me see if I can find that actual number. Success. Okay, here it is. Challenges in practice. Success rate is low nationwide, and in California, historically, under 1% of cases result in not guilty by reason of insanity, and many resolve by plea deals rather than full trials. Prosecutors often vigorously oppose it, especially in high-profile violent cases like this. Voluntary intoxication, drugs, alcohol generally does not qualify, and in this case, you'd have to go through a lot more testing. His documented history of schizophrenic disorder, medication changes, and reported delusions, knowing he killed his parents but not grasping why he's in jail or seeing it as a conspiracy, could be central to their argument, but it would hinge on expert testimony about his exact mental state on December 14th. But it has no formal plea deal has been entered publicly on this case or not regarding that. So it's a lot of testing, a lot of proving that he was unaware, because it comes down to, do they know right from wrong? Do they know the consequences of the action? And him being that functional and not institutionalized, and
But was he functional, and should he have been institutionalized? That's where my question is.
Yeah, and then that's going to come down to those expert clinicians they say about it. So if you're out, and I know functional is a strange word to many people, because you have functional alcoholics, you have functional drug addicts, and you have functional this. I think it's going to be a real stretch for them to be able to claim insanity on this one. I really, really do. Because it's the thing about this. It's not like he now should have been institutionalized is one thing, but the fact that he wasn't and existing in the world, maneuvering around the world, granted, there's a lot of really bad, abhorrent people that are just assholes that you know, would not be able to claim insanity either. They're just really bad people you don't want to be around, and he's one of them. So I think they're going to have a really hard stretch doing it, because, again, the stats on being able to claim it. I mean, just think about this. Lori Daybell Vallow was unable to get that, you know, and she murdered her kids because she said they're possessed by evil demons. I mean, we've covered cases that I think are even higher on the Nutter scale than this one, or at least on par with it, and that they haven't even been able to try. So I doubt if they're going to be able to get it.
And here's a question that's probably better for Bob, like tomorrow or sometime, but doesn't, when you plead not guilty by reason of insanity, or aren't you actually pleading guilty but insane? I mean, you're actually admitting something. I did something, but I was not in my right mind at doing it.
Yeah, that's a good legal question for Bob. Yeah.
Get him on the phone. Is Bob on the phone? Call
Bob. Get
Bob
on the phone.
Could be. Yeah, or Eric Faddis as well. That's a good question. I don't know, because, again, we haven't come across one of our cases yet that we've covered that actually it's been a defense. That's actually – so think about that too. You know, we've been doing this – I've been doing this with Tony like 4 years now, and out of all the cases we've covered, we have not covered one that actually came to that bar. So this being the first one – it's hard to stretch a thing it would be, but I don't know the consequence of that anyway. Anyway, what are your questions? Put them in the comment sections of YouTube and Substack, or message us on Facebook and Instagram. The links are in the description.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.